feast on this one.
Conceptuality is something other than itself.
There's been a change in the image of thought.
That's what it is.
That's what it is.
That's what it is.
The internal structure of becoming.
As soon as an utterance slips from the mouth, it's divorced from the subject. Who's your team, Brooke? Do you have a favorite baseball team?
Well, I do. I am a big baseball fan. I like the Washington Nationals, who are terrible this year.
Oh, are they and, really?
Yeah. So yeah, they're just. Yeah.
So what
really
happened when they traded Scherzer? Did everything just?
They did. And I don't understand why they did that. They were. Kind
series.
Of close to hanging in there, and but then just decided to rebuild, and so traded away all of these great players, including some that they had extended contracts with for a while. Like, I see trading Scherzer, even though he's my favorite, it kind of broke my heart to see him go, because he had a free agent season coming up, and he was going to be very expensive at an older age. So I get that, but they just traded away some amazing players. Now they have nobody. They're basically like a AAA team, except for Juan Soto.
It's kind of like being a fan of the Pacers.
A bit, yeah.
Or the Pirates. But the Pirates are bad too, right?
They Pittsburgh are. Although they have a player that is pretty exciting. Some like,
oh, yeah.
6'7"
like
shortstop.
Seven.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seen him.
That's and cool. The Orioles are doing kind of amazingly well this year, even though they're last place in their division. They're in that really good division after being terrible for many years. So anyway.
I did notice that there's one, I don't even know the division, but there's one division that seems like every top to bottom, they're above 500.
Yeah, that's the Yankees and the Orioles, yeah, and the Blue Jays, like that whole group. Yeah. Right.
I can't even name any players anymore. I mean, I know like Bryce Harper. I used to be super into baseball when I was in like ninth grade, and then I kind of lost. I knew because I played the video game, so I knew every single player, you know, on every team. And now they're all younger than I am now, and I don't know any of them.
Yeah. It's sad. It's a sad moment in one's life when that happens, when you realize that.
Yeah.
They are all much younger than me. There is no way I can ever enter this.
Oh, LeBron and I are the same age. Like, I think he's a month younger than I am. So when he retires, that'll be like, you know, my
It'll
NBA
happen.
Shot is over.
It'll happen for you.
That's when you start liking golf, because golf gives you another 10 years of, like, your heroes can play into their 40s. Makes sense.
Right, right. If I were a pro, I guess I'd be in my prime at 28. Is that usually when people start winning titles and shit? Right, so I'm like,
prime
I'd be like
is usually
cresting.
Something like 28 to what, 32, 33.
Right.
Yeah.
That's prime.
Yeah, that's the window. I don't feel like I'm in my prime though. I feel like that I've gone past my prime athletically at this point. I feel like I was around like 22 was like the best year. Yeah.
I think if you're not a professional athlete, that's probably true.
Probably.
Like,
right.
I think I was probably in my athletic prime in my early 20s.
But I think that, okay, so I guess we're talking about it.
We might be jumping right in the middle here.
Yeah, it really is jumping right in the middle too, but whatever. I always think that it every time, so there's the, and he does this like three different times in this interview where he says, I'm not talking about actual democracy. I'm talking about the democracy to come, or I'm not talking about the actual international. I'm talking about an internationalism of singularities. And I'm always like, but the I'm not and instead is like, but they're not either ors, right? Like, but he talks about them consistently as if they are, right? As if, and he, I mean, I'm not like telling Derrida something he didn't know, right? Like, I mean, he says, I'm not trying to get rid of the United Nations and this notion of internationality, and we believe we need to hang on to these sort of, this notion of democracy. But what I'm after is something different. And I'm like, but that whole sort of difference, the whole insistence on pointing to a difference to me is presenting it as if there's the actual and then there's the conceptual, you know, and the conceptual conditions, and they're different kinds of things. So that, like, it would seem to me, and this is the point he makes repeatedly, which is that the democracy yet to come is here and now, right? It's not an idea. It is imminent and performatively enacted. And so therefore, it is only questions of the actual. Mm-hmm. It is only circulates through questions of, like, How do you reform voter registration? How do you reform, like, you know what I mean? Like, those types of right. questions are not sort of things that others can deal with and set aside because I'm interested in the conditions of possibility. They are the whole thing.
Yeah, well, that I agree with. I mean, like, for example, with the question on Nietzsche's orientation to democracy, that I thought that was a good example of what you were talking about, in that I think he's installing like a tone or an approach to the question of Nietzsche on democracy, where you know the easy way of thinking, like asking that question, is like, does Nietzsche attack democracy, or does and maybe a slightly more nuanced version of that is, what is democracy for Nietzsche? And then realizing that there's a plurality of democracies. And, you know, the approach that Derrida seems to be installing there is more like, what senses of democracy emerge in Nietzsche's engagement with it that both, A, sort of locate a particular democracy as the object of attack, and then also posit another version of democracy, the democracy yet to come, as the point or the perspective of that attack. And this is important to me that example emerges out of the more general concern about like the way that, I can't remember if it was now Derrida or the interviewer, talk about it as Nietzsche's obsession with how the weaker can become the stronger.
That's right.
And then
that's
that creating right. that dual relationship where, like, the weaker is only ever weaker in relationship to a particular kind of stronger, or weaker is always only another kind of stronger, that right. or another kind of strength. So just introducing that notion of sense that sense into the question, where it prevents the totalizing response of, well, yes, Nietzsche is attacking democracy. No, he is not attacking democracy. This is what gets to count as democracy in this case, that, you know, that's what he's refusing to close.
Oh, and I get that, which is like, any critique of democracy that Nietzsche might have offered, it has to be being done in the name of something. Right, like it has to be like, if you say there's a problem with this structure, it's like, well, the recognition of a problem is always done in the interest of some other potential possible future formation, right? So it's I get that, and honestly, as you were responding, I was thinking, like, maybe I'm taking them the task for being in an interview, because it's an interview. Mm-hmm. Right, like that, and so a treatment that you could imagine, the Derridean treatment in like a sort of longer form, like Inspectors of Marx in that case, of the democracy stuff, that parsing that out works differently. And I also really like the point, especially as it comes up at the end, which I thought was really important, about like the rhythm of thinking and the connection of thinking to language and language to action. And it's like, no, this is an action. Like, we are doing this. It's happening, you know, right here, right now. And that's the lesson of deference. It's not deferral to some future point. It's like, no, right here, right now. That's a hugely important one for me.
Which is why I think you can also answer your question about the supposed separation between the actual and the conceptual in the exact opposite direction, is that those quote-unquote practical, actual questions are conceptual questions hidden in sheep's clothing. That, you know, to ask, like, what do we do about voter registration installs, without thinking about it, a ton of generic concepts that then get smeared across a whole lot of other things. But attending to the singularity in which a particular set of conceptual orientations open up the actual, that is, like, in some ways, that commonsensical notion of doing the conceptual work is far more concrete and practical than is the supposedly concrete question of, you know, this or that thing, which just hides its conceptuality, hides the, you know,
I agree.
Maybe another way into it is metaphoricity.
The stuff on the decision, which I used to love, right, like, is really great, where, you know, and he's really clear. It's like, I'm not saying I'm against reason and thinking and analysis, that one has to do tons of that stuff. It's just at the moment of the decision, you know, if there is one, and that'll be important in a second, but, like, you know, it has to be heterogeneous to that order. And that's an example for me now, when I read it now, as opposed to 10 years ago, when I was like, oh, that's really great. Now I'm like, why is the preparatory analytical work not itself internal to the decision. You know what I'm saying? Like, why do you not say all of these are decisions that are getting made all along? It's not like there's some long, protracted preparation for a heterogeneous moment. There are only heterogeneous moments within the analytical conceptual preparatory, quote unquote. So in other words, it's not preparatory at all.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Wouldn't difference be imminent to every thinking every process within that? Yeah. Like, that's why I was confused. Like, what? Because he sets up that opposition between sort of just following a system and then the heterogeneous decision. And I was thinking, at least ontologically, even if you're following a schematic all the way through, like, wouldn't there still be difference involved, enough contingency involved in the articulating of that system where it would still be necessarily, like, heterogeneous or aleatory? Like, you wouldn't be able to just follow a structure, like, perfectly, right? So even if you are doing that, difference is still imminent to that process.
Because you are performatively producing the structure that you will have followed. So it's not like this, I'm agreeing, like, it's not like the structure simply pre-exists and you enter into it.
Right, exactly.
I think that, you know, hearing you describe it like this, I mean, I have to say, I actually really like I still really like the discussion of the decision in this way, for reasons I can describe in a second. But I will say that in later, like more recent pieces where he talks about this, it's to me much more explicit, the kind of role of mechanics, technics, right, that are also, that inhabit pure response, not reaction, right? So I think that becomes much clearer, like in The Animal Therefore That I Am, or he's a lot clearer later, it seems to me, that there is this kind of, you know, so whereas in The Decision, all of the kind of apparatus that helps you make the decision, the data, the algorithm, whatever cause and effect reasoning you have, right, there is a kind of falling away of all that, and the decision is just this kind of step into the abyss where none of that helps you anymore. Not that it doesn't matter, but in that moment, it's a cutting away of those things. And
but it's as if it's a different moment than the preparatory moment.
And then I do think that there are moments when later where he'll write about similar processes, and he'll emphasize more the fact that you actually can never get rid of all those machinic responses that you have, you know, that's also inside of what would be this more
That's a really cool connection that you made right there for me with the animal book.
Yeah.
Insofar as it's interesting that there's a way in which, and I can understand the logic of it, there's an attempt to save the mechanicity of the animal as being not simply mechanical, but the mechanicity of reason, like, it's more Heideggerian in that regard, right? Like, that Heidegger is like, look at the mechanicity, or the, you know, the metaphysical qualities of rationality and that norm, you know, the ways in which that works. And, like, that's a bad thing that we sort of want to get away from. But in the context of the animal, it's like, no, that mechanicity is not sheerly mechanicity. But I really like how you're thinking it, is like, to say the thinking in that context, it's not because animals are better and that mechanicity is better in animals because it's somehow organic, but it's more just saying, like, at this moment, at this historical moment, he's problematizing a certain function of rationality, and at this moment, he's problematizing a certain function of the problematizing of rationality.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
Which
well, actually starts, like that, I mean, that's the whole, like, to me, that's the really cool beginning. For me, I really liked the beginning this time more than I have in the past, because he's like, you know, we don't need to save Nietzsche like Heidegger attempted to do. And he's like, and the reason why not is because I'm not writing between two world wars, right? Mm-hmm. Like, like, that's
that
it.
Explicitly.
It's that simple. It's like, I'm writing at a moment, and it just gives you that sense of, and of course it's true and we all realize it, but that we're historically embedded in the things that we're responding to, like the problem of saving Heidegger, or the problem of saving Nietzsche, which was Heidegger's problem for all kinds of totally understandable reasons. It's just not Derrida's problem, right? Like, that's just not the nexus at which we're engaged in readings of Nietzsche anymore. So
that is something I want to talk about, is sort of the linkages that attach the stuff in the first half of the essay or the, of the interview about Heidegger and his relationship to Nietzsche, and Derrida's relationship to Heidegger, and then the seemingly abrupt transition to the question of decision, which is what we're mostly focused on here. But before we go in that direction further, I just kind of wanted to set up like part of what drew us to the one of the major dynamics that we're focusing on here vis-a-vis the decision is a certain kind of tension between the desire to make choices or to create or to create the conditions of possibility for a future that are not simply mechanically determined. And I think, I mean, Brooke, that's what has drawn you to it, because your current research project is sort of focused on the one hand, a discourse and ethics of betting and gambling and its linkage to a more political, technological, political regime of reading and interpreting big data and then making high-level decisions about things like pandemics and gun laws and that the central tension between following out mechanically, fascistically a system or a protocol, and then the capacity to actually make decisions that are either within that, heterogeneous to it, whatever. But I mean, I think this would be, if you're open to it, just a good time for you to sort of talk through your investment in that.
Yeah, thanks.
Wasn't that cool how Nathaniel would like took on the role of as host? He's like, yeah. I mean, that was a really great moment. Like, it was even the very beginning of your comment, like, let me set the stage and then invite Brooke in. Like, no, that was great.
Well, it was great until you interrupted.
That's just what I was going to say. It was so seamless. Well, thank you for that artful segue, Nathaniel.
Thanks for having me on the show. First time caller, long time listener.
Friend of the show.
Open seat on the show.
And it is true. I am kind of interested in this idea of wagering. And I think I got interested in it in relation to reading Derrida on the decision, or the two, like the practice of it, the thought of it, and thinking about it with Derrida on the decision seemed very powerful to me. And it has for a long time, although I think recently, kind of post-pandemic, 2022, where we are now, in lots of areas of culture, from these kind of important political things that you mentioned, like gun laws, how do we manage life in the pandemic era, but also much more like from baseball, like sports analytics. I really feel like we're at this moment where our life is more and more organized around using data to manage these small decisions, and at more and more points we are given information to make better decisions, and to think about our individual circumstance against the backdrop of this huge data set that really can give us some kind of probabilities that could help us decide how to make the wise choice. So much so that I do think it seems quite mechanistic. And
what was the example that you gave in your talk? It was such a great example. It was the pitcher that was pulled after the seventh inning in the World Series.
Could you
say that one again? Because I remember hearing about it in the sports world, and then when you gave your talk, I was like, oh, that's such a perfect example of the problem.
Right. So there is this, so baseball is maybe the sport that was earliest to come to Moneyball or sabermetrics, and there was this analytic that said by the time pitchers get the third time through the order, their efficiency begins to fall off, and that's because the batter the third time through has gotten a better look, has a better sense of how to respond to the pitches that come. And so it is the case, the data does show that the third time through the order, batters do better against the same pitcher. So the effect that this is having is that it is really phasing out the starting pitcher. Like, the starting pitcher is a dinosaur. You know, not only do they no longer go nine innings like they used to when I was young.
Even go seven.
Right, right. So, and if you look, there was, in fact, just this week or last week, Jeff Passan did this story where he looked at the way this has trickled down. No minor league players go more than like 3 to 5 innings. Wow. So in 10 years, there's not going, I mean, we'll just have all mid relievers, you know, right. Like all three innings at a time, which is very, I mean, not why we watch baseball, right? But this particular example was, I guess it was, was it 2020? The 2020 World Series, it was the Tampa Bay Rays against the Dodgers. The Dodgers would win that World Series, but the Rays were like, putting up a fight, right? They had a lead in this game and their pitcher, Blake Snell, was, you know, like killing it. He was, you know, they could not hit him. And he was at something like 75 pitches, so not even near that 100 pitch mark that kind of tends to be the cutoff these days for when fatigue sets in and they begin to worry. But he was approaching that third time through the order and the manager came and took him out. And put in the mid reliever who over the course of the season had had good numbers, you know, like on paper, it seemed like a good choice to make. But recently that mid reliever had been struggling and like people were hitting him like crazy. And so he took out this, you know, this amazing starter having like the best game of his life, put in this struggling mid reliever. And they hit him right away, you know, and he had a wild pitch and then they, the Dodgers came back and won the game and everybody was kind of pointing to this moment, like you had a chance and this was the decisive moment that blew it for you. And the comment that he made after, Kevin Cash, the manager, was like, yeah, I regret what happened, but I don't regret the decision because I made the right decision. It just didn't go right, you know, and it's that thinking of the decision to me that that's not what a decision is, right? Like, yes, you followed what the protocol would suggest, what the kind of sabermetrics tell you to do. You type numbers into a machine, and you did what those numbers told you to do. But it strikes me as that, like, that thinking that he articulated in that post-game comment, it's not just for that one baseball game. It's like, this is how we're being encouraged to live our lives now. You know, like, take a look at your COVID.
It's like, what's missing from the equation, if we call all of those analytics like the equation, is a variable called the aleatory, right? This is the question, is like, it's not simply about chipping away from the aleatory and taking things that we used to call aleatory and now making them into equation. It's saying mm-hmm. the aleatory is mm-hmm. an internal dimension or needs to be thought as an internal dimension of the equation. We usually call that, you know, we call it in the case of sports, we like, you know, the eye test or shit like that, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, mm-hmm. well, the numbers all say this, but the eye test says something else. But that's not even a very good way of thinking about it, I don't think. It's not like one is opposed to the other. It's just sort of like that the application of the equation should itself be thought as an eye test, which is like the moments where it makes sense to apply rigorous analytics mm-hmm. and when are the moments that it doesn't. Like, so it's like there's almost like a baseline equation for when equations should be used.
Yeah. Well, and there's also a way that he wasn't following the more recent analytics, because the trend of that game, for instance, is that Snell is killing it. So if you just follow mm-hmm. inning by inning trends, and then like you said, that mid relieving pitcher had been struggling recently, so maybe his mm-hmm. overall ERA was solid, but his ERA for the last few games was high. So it's almost like he actually wasn't following the analytics.
So that's a different question, right? Like,
which algorithm do you follow? Like,
exactly.
Which set?
Like, what's the algorithm? Right. What's the algorithm for picking the algorithm?
Right.
And I would even say, like, I mean, part of what I have been thinking in the sort of the what John was talking about earlier is like, what does it even look like to simply follow the program without inserting the decision, as if decisions are of one order and the following of the program is another order? And I think in one sense that's very much the case, and that's exactly what Derrida is getting at there, is that if you just follow the program, then no decision has been made. And if there is a decision, then it must be heterogeneous to the following of a program. I just don't, I'm not sold on the possibility of programs being simply followed.
Yeah.
You know, even at the conceptual level, and you know, like at the beginning of your example, Brooke, you said, you know, this analytic says by the time you get through the third time in the order, then efficiency drops off. And then you said because the batters are starting to figure them out. And I said that what follows that because is, I mean, it makes sense. You know, I mean, like that is a narrative that explains, you know, the statistical phenomenon. But it's not what the statistics show, I don't think. I don't think the statistics have a because. I think you can attach a number of becauses there, and one of the most obvious ones, I think, is precisely what you said. But, you know, there would have to be, I think this is what we were just getting at, is that there would have to be two other locations for the decision. One is, where do you cut that analytic on? Like, what counts within that analytic? What's the recency bias? What's the scope of the thing? How does it apply to certain kind? Like I'm sure that, I don't know, I'm sure there's a discrepancy between left-handed pitchers and right-handed pitchers, or righties against going right against righties, or lefties going against righties, whatever else it might be. But then I think there's also another species of the decision within it, even within the analytic itself. The decisions that are forced to attach one causal link to another, because I'm increasingly skeptical of the idea that anything simply follows anything else. That there can only be, I mean, I don't think, you know, that anything can go, anything can be attached to anything else in all of the, in just as easily as anything else. But I'm also just as skeptical that, you know, even within the most calculable of sciences, that there really, like, it seems that there's always moments of decisions that, that, you know, end up linking this thing to that way. And that's the mechanism by which causal,
No, I totally agree. And I think that one of the things that is a little concerning to me about this kind of approach to decision making that I think we see so clearly in sports, but really has kind of been handed to us individually, just in terms of how we manage safety and risk in our own lives. It is that, and not only is it like, yes, so you're totally right. That third time through the order, the studies that they've done, the numbers they've crunched to come up with that, they don't say why, like, and kind of
they
happily
can't. They couldn't, yeah,
right, like, and but that's the thing. It's like it just, and you know, reasonable people could like maybe assume, and you could make guesses that. You know, who knows, perhaps they're likely right, might be other things as well. But the statistics are like, yeah, it doesn't matter why. Just follow the number. Like,
take
just
them out.
Just yeah. And it's almost it's an abdication of responsibility, like when he says, yeah, I regret it didn't work out, but I don't regret the decision because I made the right
one.
Isn't
that weird? What a weird response to have. It's like, I regret that it didn't work out, but I don't regret the decision. You're like,
yeah.
How, as a just as a baseball coach, like,
right.
Wouldn't that mean that you
might as well just have a computer be the manager?
Yeah.
Oh, you're gonna feast on this one, but
because,
it's the same thing that happened with Paul George and Damian Lillard when Lillard ended the season with that crazy deep shot, and George's response was like, it was a bad shot. Now, obviously it went in, so in that sense it was a good shot, but like, you know, like given that historical moment where he took the shot and where he took the shot and how George was defending, like there's a, like in some senses he's right is there as well. It's like, make him take the bad shot.
I really love that. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I mean, yeah, it is, it's just this, it's like we're being asked to advocate responsibility on several different levels. Like, yeah, so I regret the outcome but not the decision, because the decision was proper. Sure. And I don't have to decide why these numbers are right. I'm just going to trust that they are. Third time through the order, that's, you know, I'm going to pull. So And I think that's how we're being asked to kind of manage our lives more and more. You know, like, here's a bunch of data. You set your own parameters for risk and you decide.
I mean, there are several levels that are really interesting to me of this. And one is the point that Nathaniel brought up about the installing of the reason. And I think that it doesn't matter why. Actually, does matter. Like, there's a presumption of the reason. For instance, here's another explanation for that phenomena, which is that most people's arms get tired.
Yeah, right? Totally.
It has nothing to do with being faced for the third time. It's just that at that point, their arms get tired. Mm-hmm. But of course, there could be exceptions. Like, this guy hasn't done anything with his arm for several days or what, you know, like, and if that's your underlying presumption, you're going to have a different understanding of the analysis. But the larger point you're making is one that I feel like I've ranted about on this podcast before, where I'm like, this is one of my frustrations working in higher education, is that I feel like everybody uses policy as a way of avoiding taking responsibility for making a decision. Mm-hmm. Like, well, the policy is this. It's like, but yeah, but the circumstances are not identical to the policy. Like, the task, mm-hmm, I've always felt like every person in those situations is, given a policy and given a situation, how do we make these things fit, as opposed to simply how do we subsume the particular situation under this notion of policy. And it's consistently, and smart, caring, attentive people that are like, they throw up their hands at the existence of policy, because policy means the algorithm, or it's the equivalent of that. Like, no, in this situation, in X situation, we do Y. It's also why, when you had something like the pandemic, I had so many of my colleagues just like, what the fuck do I do on the exam that I've assigned next week? Or how do I deal with this paper that I've given my students? It's like, they didn't have a policy and they were waiting, and people were angry at the administration for not already having a policy, because, and my reaction to it, and I got tons of emails from people, like colleagues of mine, and I'm like, you're the fucking grown up, make a decision, right? Like, that's your job, is this unprecedented circumstance that has arisen. So now make a decision. But they were not just flummoxed by not having a policy, but angry at the administration for not, you know, having anticipated, or at least very, very quickly come up with a policy that would allow them to avoid making any decisions. And these are PhD, these are very smart people who, like, I don't know if it's that they didn't want to do the wrong thing or they didn't want to be on the wrong side, but it was really, I mean, I ranted about the teaching award situation. We'll have to edit this one out too, of course, but like, there's this teaching award situation. It's the same kind of circumstance where everyone agrees that the quantitative teaching evaluations are bad. They're just, like, on so many levels, they're terrible. And I was like, then let's not use them. And people were like, that's crazy. That's out of control. Like, that's radical. And that's...
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my fucking God, every one of you recognizes a problem, and no one wants to take the responsibility of saying, let's do something different. Like, this thing's bad, and no one wants to, and that's a consistent. So when I mean, that's, those are the things to me, like, I see way more now when I think of it as policy and not necessarily like data-driven analytics, although I understand that in the abstract. But when I think of it in terms of like my institutional life, the existence of policy is the ways that people avoid responsibility for making any kind of decision, and they think that's their job.
But right? I think this needs to be the refrain, is that there is no such thing as abnegating responsibility. There is no such thing as avoiding the moment of decision, because the throwing up of the hands, or saying it's the policy, or it's saying policy, that's what the analytics told me, that is the decision, right? I mean, even if it's the machine that is being installed, it still is being installed in that moment, configured that way, you know, with all of the various contingencies attached to it. But like, there is a decision there being made. And, you know, the decision to sort of toss the policy out or sort of contort it in different ways, to me, is no more radical than the decision to simply follow it.
Like, this is where, okay, so this is one of the, and I kind of get, and maybe you guys can help me with this one, because the decision, if there is one, is the recurring refrain, like that there may not be a decision, you know, like, I kind of get why he's doing that, just because he always does that with like writing, if there is such a thing, or, you know, and I understand it in those contexts. But in this particular context, I keep wanting to say all there are decisions.
Right, it's difference.
Right.
How can that be? If decision is the movement of difference, then like, that's all there can be is is decisions or
so
a
why
field.
Does he want to hang on to okay so why does he I, want I, to well, hang on to
that one? I think he's pretty clear on in several places is because he's talking about it from the perspective of knowledge, right? So like yeah. because the decision is heterogeneous to the order of knowledge, then one right. cannot say there are and decisions within decision. As a knowledge claim, right? And right. you know part of the one of the more interesting things that I got out of reading at this time was the self-effacing nature of the decision. Like, as the installation of a machine, whatever it is, right, the whatever has been installed is going to then reinterpret the decision that has installed
yeah,
it
yeah,
in
yeah,
within
right.
the order of knowledge. And so if that's the decision right. itself is heterogeneous to the order of knowledge, its reinterpretation or resubsumption, whatever the word, you know the word, has now like it's now rendered it as something other than a decision, or has rendered it as a decision in accordance with its own logic. Right. So makes sense to me.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I do get that, but just politically, the valence would be so much, at least for me, way more interesting were he to say the exact opposite thing. And it's like, yes, of course, we don't know that there was a decision, and there's nothing but decisions. Like, every preparatory, like, that's all we're doing is perpetually making these decisions on microscopic levels, right? Like, you know, little shit. Like, am I going to talk now or are you going to talk now or whatever?
What I took as, in terms of his concern there is the relationship of the decision to responsibility, right? And what he seems to be forestalling is the capacity to say, I made a decision that was in line with my responsibility and now therefore I am absolved.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Right. Okay. Which I think actually, I think that explanation fits more Brooks' example of the manager saying, I made a decision. The decision was to stick within here and now I am absolved of, like, I didn't like the outcome, but I am absolved of the culpability of having that outcome be realized. Yeah, exactly. Right. Being realized. And so I think that has a whole lot to do with it is, I mean, the route that you want to go to say that there are only decisions, that links itself to responsibility, I think, very differently, wherein then one is never absolved of responsibility. Right.
Yeah, and isn't that what Derrida wants to say? Right.
Like, oh, that's absolutely what he wants to say. Right. And in the political, but just think about the difference there would be politically speaking if no one was ever resolved of responsibility, or in the language of the paper that I delivered at our last panel of debt. No one is absolved of this. Therefore, no one can just throw up their hands. And it would make sense to me to turn to as another historical example, given the Heidegger Nazi stuff, or just like the Nuremberg trials and, you know, like the simply following orders. It's like there is no such thing as simply following orders, right? They can be the decision to do that might be then retroactively reinscribed within the decision or the order making or the law making apparatus is like, yeah, you were just following orders, but like there was a perpetual series of decisions that allowed you to interpret your actions vis-a-vis rule following mechanisms that does not absolve you of, you know, like one of the effects of articulating this to yourself might be the feeling of having been absolved of responsibility. It was someone else's decision, not mine, or in Brooks' case, it was the algorithm's decision, not mine, but that's only from within the perspective of that machine itself.
Right. It seems like more of a, I mean, it seems like an ethical distinction rather than an ontological distinction, the way that we're articulating it, but it seems like at least in that moment when he's talking about, like, where you could not make a decision. You could just follow the system, follow the algorithm, and then just assume the effects of that algorithm. Like, it seems like ontologically speaking, like you were saying, John, each of those moments, even when you're following, would still be decisions, right? It's like the distinction between, like, we brushed up against this with Heidegger, the distinction between, ontologically, between, like, good thinking or real true thinking and then calculative or business-like thinking. And I think what we came to in one of those episodes was like, why are they different kinds or levels of thinking for Heidegger? Wouldn't they be on that same plane? Even if they're qualitatively different or ethically, you know, divergent. Like, wouldn't they be on the same plane? Like, necessarily?
That That's where I do think it's important to hook this back to what Nathaniel mentioned a while back of the sort of, I don't even know if the right word is ambiguity of Nietzsche, right? Where, mm-hmm. like, who is Nietzsche? What is the truth of Nietzsche? What does Nietzsche say? Let's just stick with that, right? Like, what does Nietzsche say about X? What does Nietzsche say about democracy, about technics, about whatever else? And Derrida's like, he doesn't say anything, or he says lots of things that can't simply be reduced to a position. Mm-hmm. And or rather, the other way of saying it is what he says is any given proposition can be reactively or active, you know, reactive force or active force can take hold. And so that's the play of forces that constitutes any given proposition, mm-hmm. right, or any given quote unquote decision. And that's the issue then for Nietzsche. I mean, that's what he says, right? Mm-hmm. He says that there are, that's the positive thing that you can attribute to Nietzsche is that there are no facts, there are only interpretations. And so all you're dealing with, like ontologically, right? Like is just the variations on reactive force or active force taking hold of, you know, whatever the claim, whatever the proposition is. And this would be simply an example of, like, the attempt to absolve oneself of responsibility would be an example of that reactive force. Like, I am not making a decision. I am simply playing out the program, which is not to say that you couldn't also. So let's imagine, like, for a second, like, let's imagine what would be a really interesting way of thinking the coach's response. It's like, look, no matter what I did, I would have been, I was making a decision regardless, and I made the right decision because what counts as a right decision is coherence with pre-existing data, with history, right? Let's just say it that way. So what counts as a right decision, I mean, what we mean by right decision is examining history and acting in accordance with precedent, probabilistically. Always probabilistically, but you're always going to get it wrong. Mm-hmm. So you can say, like, he's making an argument for the importance of exactly what Derrida is saying about all the preparatory stuff and whatever, and the playing. But that's where you get back to, for me, you get back to the Derrida. If Derrida wants to say that that moment of decision has to be heterogeneous, it's like, why does it have to be heterogeneous? Like, why can't that moment of decision be just a playing out of the program? And then the experience might be one of absolving oneself of responsibility.
Well, what is it?
But the ontological relation.
What does it mean for it to be heterogeneous? Like, is that
a different order?
To the order of knowledge, like, yeah,
right.
To the order of knowledge, right? So the decision cannot be subsumed within the understanding,
right?
Because the decision itself is a cut that cuts a particular order of understanding and installs a new one.
But
which is
that
why
a
the decision
cut? From the understanding, is that like,
no, this is, no.
I know, but I'm saying, how do you, like, well, I guess you can't identify it as a decision. So
right,
there's just
you
no way.
That's why
to,
you don't know if there's a decision. Right. You don't even
that's
know if there's
why
a decision.
That, yeah, hence the repetition of that phrase, if there is one, because the cutting that you could say is linking two systems together is effaced in both directions, right? It has sort of arisen out of one order, installs another order, and is retroactively reinterpreted by both of them. But both of those orders of knowledge are heterogeneous to the decision, the cut itself.
Because let's imagine another scenario. Let's imagine this scenario with the baseball coach. He goes, okay, all the data says I should pull him, but the guy's on fire, so I'm going to leave him in, and I'm going to go with my gut. So what I'm doing is I'm making a decision to not use this algorithm, but to use the gut algorithm. And he puts the guy out there for the gut algorithm. The guy gets shelled, and they lose the game. And they go, oh, my God, you didn't. And he's like, well, it's just a question of which algorithm I'm producing. Right. So it's not like I intervened in a heterogeneous way at all.
Right.
I just made a different kind of decision at that moment using the gut or the eye test algorithm instead of the analytics algorithm.
Right.
Which is just another algorithm, right? So it's not like it's a subjective decision where suddenly, like, I just went with,
I want to be heterogeneous.
You know, subjectivity. Right, I want to be heterogeneous. So even that is subsumed within, it's within a machine. It's just the machine is one of guts, mm-hmm. you know, or eye tests or whatever you want to call it.
And in that case, I do think it's more, it has the facade of being a little more organic. I mean, literally, right? It's, I went with my gut.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it has a higher risk because they might have fired him. right? Like, he didn't. I mean, he's an analytics guy. They've been successful because of analytics, all of these things. Mm-hmm. So there is that, like, veneer to that in that particular example. But I think for Derrida, like, what matters about the decision, if there is one, it is this. It's also a denial of that, just go with your gut.
Yeah.
It's not that totally. Either, right? It's because the decision involves a kind of giving oneself over to the aleatory, to the future, right? The future, to, like, there is a way that the future kind of inscribes itself in the person who makes the decision, mm-hmm. and kind of it takes away your mastery, right? I think that's an important aspect of it. So not even like, I don't want to sound like I wanted him to leave the pitcher in and go with his gut. Like, that really isn't the point. It's, mm-hmm. But it is a kind of like, it's a giving oneself over. And in that moment, it's like, you're no longer like making the decision in this confident, way that you won't regret, right? It's a kind of openness.
You're either always going to regret or you're never... I mean, that's the flip side of this is there's a way of saying, and you know how I feel about the gut. I gave that talk of, like, don't mm-hmm. trust your gut, right? Like, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. gut is itself... The way of saying that is the gut is itself a machine. It's an algorithm that constitutes itself. So, I mean, we call it intuition or we call it whatever, but it's still a kind of machine, and that machine is fabricated and made in particular kinds of ways, right? Like, so it's no more aleatory to go with your gut than it is to sort of follow the analytics in that case. It's mm-hmm. just a different kind of machine that you're choosing from. But in that sense, there's no responsibility, right? Because there's no, in the sense of me having responsibility for a decision, it's not me. Well, it's just,
I think we have to take the performative
of
aspects of it as well. And this is sort of, I mean, returning to Brooke's original examples, both of the baseball game and then also where that's bled out into our everyday life of, like, what do you do? And like, do I go to the party? I think this is sort of like the locality of what you're talking about. Do I go to this party given the statistical, case
super
rate of COVID and my, like, and then also, compounding it by my own health risks and whatever, right? Like, how do I make this decision here? And at least part of the tension that you're focused on are two orientations of those moments to the future, right? And there's a tension between two notions of futures, that machines or programs supposedly realize futures, whereas decisions make futures. And the important, like, those probably sound a little bit too similar to each other, but, the machine projects a future and then does its best to realize it within a certain degree of failure or success. That success and failure becomes the metric by which the future is judged. The decision, at least the way that Derrida talks about it here, is that it's a creative act that now opens, like, it literally creates new parameters for what a future can be like, which means it can't be realized or not realized, and it cannot be, as you said, there has to be a giving up of mastery. Mm-hmm. Not just because of the aleatory dimension of it, but because the performative act is not simply the extension of my will. Yeah. It is the remaking. It is the performative, like, the subject has been retroactively installed. So there is a responsibility, but there's a responsibility there, but it's a very different kind of responsibility. So the responsibility is not, am I responsible for the future that has happened and then judged in terms of the morality of that, like that, not that kind of responsible, but now I am now subject to, the I that I have become is now subject to this future. That's a different orientation of a responsibility. And it makes me want to actually turn to some of the other stuff that you write on, Brooke, in terms of ethos as well. Mm-hmm. Is that in many ways, that the example of the manager doing this, it seems these aren't decisions. These are just very upfront, straightforward instances of rhetorical ethos. The algorithm has a certain kind of authority, and I defer to it. Right there, and that's one way of abnegating.
That's a cool way of thinking of it, by the way, to think of ethos of the machine, right? The quantitative analysis comes with an... In other words, it's making an argument by its sheer quantitative existence.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly, mm-hmm. right? Which is now, mm-hmm. I am subject to this thing. There is an... There, like, ethos is the relationship that is defining me as decision-making maker to this apparatus. But then there's another sense of ethos in that second sense of responsibility is that the making of the future here is also simultaneously the making of a new subjectivity, making of a new ethos in its relationship to that. And right. like that dynamic, I think, is incredibly important. And I really want to make this a little bit more extract the human in terms of the conscious, you know, responsible subject mm-hmm. making decision. And like, I'm increasingly suspicious of a machine having the capacity to, and I mean this in a very precise way, play itself out in a homogenous kind of way. I don't know what it would be for the algorithm to simply, and I'm in this one I'm going to put an asterisk on, play saying. Itself
yeah.
off.
Yeah,
if we mean play itself out as in a homogenous line that links necessarily every line forward as if it were simply an equation
Which
or
is,
idealized
as if
version
no,
of
something. Right, as if there's no alternative. Alterity that it's encountering.
As if there's no alterity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do think algorithms and machines play themselves out all of the time, right? And that they do make linkages between things all of the time, but there is still an aleatory, heterogeneous relationship there. It is never simply the homogeneous movement of, you know, the self-contained identity, whatever the core equation is. Let's call it efficiency. Whatever that core equation is of efficiency in its relationship to, by the way, effectivity. We always love to talk about efficiency without like what counts as efficiency, right? That's that other mystery term. But I don't think that there is one way in which that has to play itself out. There is no homogeneous notion of efficiency that then necessarily plays itself out. There are decisions made all of the time about how efficiency gets articulated and related to this and then re-articulating it related to this that I don't think are simply human conscious decisions. It is sort of like the decision making of the machine in some kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting to think about the way, you know, I am interested in this moment where we are remade in the moment of the decision and that it is a kind of, you know, the self is wagered right at every moment, in the moment of every decision,
and always lost.
Yes, I don't know the mechanics of these things well enough, but isn't it the case that, you know, the algorithm is remade when you choose whatever show you choose on Netflix, right? Like that changes the. It's like it is. There is a way that it's happening. At this level too, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't simply have to be this kind of human-centric.
And we're back at the problem of repetition.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right.
You know.
Yeah.
The sort of empty repetition, or you know, whatever mechanical reproduction, right? This is Benjamin.
Right. Right.
You also get the sense.
But
that,
I do think.
Go ahead.
I mean, just to kind of maybe to tie up this thread of the conversation. I mean, I do think that we're at this moment now where we're much more conscious of being asked to wager, you know, with who we are, with our safety, with our, you know what I mean? It's like, it's almost like it's reached this level of, I mean, experience, yes, but it's not simply a metaphor, right? Like we're not simply like, you know, like betting our lives, but kind of we're asked to do that all the time, right? With, mm-hmm. you know,
risk assessment, cost benefit analysis, like that's those sort of large amorphous economic terms have become part of our daily lives when we like fucking walk out the door, right? Like, every moment, even when we're inside our houses, right? Like that.
But just think about the way that those big data assessments presume and then also make the individualized subject, right? Is that, you know, where does it locate responsibility? Increasingly on the individual.
Yeah.
Where you know, this is, it's not just risk assessment, it's my risk assessment and my tolerance for my risk tolerance as well. Sure. And, you know, it creates a funneling point where all of the pressure, all of the weight of that decision making falls on a single person.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Well, totally. It's an atomizing amount of response of rebellion. Yeah. So I think of it, and it just to concretize it a little bit, it's like, I feel all the time in terms of taking care of my mom's health, right? Like, I feel all the time like I'm just not doing enough research. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just, mm-hmm. I do a fair amount or whatever, but it doesn't matter how much you do. It's like, I haven't read every article on COVID exposures. I don't know everything about this thing. Right. And I'm making decisions partly because I'm like, I don't believe anyone can know all of the research, and I'm making a best guess. I do, you know, mm-hmm. like, is this a good thing to go to? Should she go to this event at the church where there's going to be 50 people inside of the, you know, whatever? And I'm always in this position of like, I'm going to fail. Yeah. Like, it's in, because I have internalized that sense of like, I must be responsible for whatever decision. You know, and it, so that's the flip side of that sense of the responsibility falls to the atomized individual, though the demand to assume it comes from everything, right?
Yeah.
Like mm-hmm. everything out there.
And when in a situation where the stakes are less high, like people invite that kind of quantifying of their whole selfhood into their lives, like with fitness trackers and health trackers and stuff like that, where the telos or the trajectory or system is a success failure operation where like you're told mm-hmm. you don't meet these goals and right you have to get a 10,000 20,000 steps or your heart rate needs to get to this point, and people become obsessed with these analytics or metrics, and I think it generates a lot of anxiety in the individual, you know, generally
speaking. Or self-assurity.
But also motivation right? Like, I mean, it's like, okay, I'm gonna get,
it's,
I
changed
my
dad's
10,
life,
like,
right? Yeah, he's
good.
Like, yeah. Yeah, and for him, you know, it's like you're installing that success failure metric, mm-hmm. and you're right. I do think it introduces an obsession. I would go back to Brooks Lim. It's like it's not, you're adding obsession onto the prior individual. You've made it an individual that is constituted
by
this
obsession.
Kind of obsession
with risk assessment. Well, and risk is the negative term, but like what's a performance optimization.
Yeah,
right. Would be the positive way of saying, like, I'm going to optimize my, this is like the Joe Rogan thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. I will optimize my life.
Yep.
Is the flip side of the risk management, which is the sort of negative downside of it.
But that takes all the calculation into, like, what it does is it reifies the good and the bad, and it moves all of the mental operation into the logistics of the how to avoid this, how to create conditions of possibility where this is realized more, the likelihood of this being realized is less than that being realized, whereas the question of the optimization of what, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's those are the questions that are generally left to the wayside.
Yeah.
I think the answer for the Joe Rogan strand, the answer is always life, right? Like, it's life optimization. This is Foucault, right? Like, productive power and the generating the powers of life, the forces of life, increasing vitality.
Right.
We want more life, more intensely, more.
But that's is the difference between the will to power and the will to have power, right?
Yeah,
because
I mean,
if the optimization is for a pre-established subjectivity, then that is very different than the optimization of life itself, which very well may necessitate or by happenstance sort of involve the destruction of maybe not just the, you know, ethical, juridical, political subject, but the biological life of the person as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. Like, what does life care about, you know, the biological organism that I call me, right?
But
it doesn't particularly care about it.
Yeah, I mean, the Joe Rogan.
But I mean,
in fact, my existence might be a problem for the continuance of life writ large.
Right.
But that's life as a general category.
Yeah.
Life as its instantiation in you, which is to say, like, the Nathaniel Street version of life has its own will to power, right? Like, it's its own instantiation, and we all have them, and then from that emerges social orders or vice versa, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to, like, but again, even within that more, like, you know, from life to a life, right, there would still have to be the perpetual upheaval of, you know, this or that version of Nathaniel.
Right. I agree. And there is a sense in which, I mean, I agree with that. And there is a sense in which, like, that notion of life optimization is so acontextual and mm-hmm. so non-responsive. It's just like, I want to be the best me that I can be seems like something that I'm supposed to undertake that has nothing to do.
You shouldn't should advertise have nothing it.
To do with the circumstances of my life, right? Like, it's like that's again another responsibility that falls on me to optimize my life.
Well, it creates like false
man,
hope.
Man, I mean,
too,
we're
I
just
think.
Guilty fucking individuals. Like, we're always failing. At this.
Failing
like,
at that.
You should love
I think
this
the best
group.
Thing about me is that I've died, you know, dozens of times. And the more I die, the better, the happier I am in some ways.
The Joe Rogan thing, one last thing on the life optimization thread is that it creates, because people want answers to whatever, if they have a lot of inflammation, mm-hmm. they want to find a quick solution to that. And that approach finds answers advertises answers that aren't, you know, necessarily that beneficial for everybody. Like, it's like, all right, you have to take an ice bath every day. Okay, tomorrow it's actually heat is what reduces inflammation. Oh, you want to get rid of depression? Well, then psychedelics is the new thing that's come onto the scene. That's going to cure you of anxiety and depression. So it's like all of they're just constantly reaching for the next solution to your problems. And I think it creates...
But to me, the problem with that isn't the clumsiness of it, right? It's not the clumsiness of it because, you know, like, I don't know, turmeric baths, I'm sure, are fantastic for some people and terrible for others. Hopefully
baths,
someone hears
is that a thing?
I don't think it is, but I really hope someone hears it and turns it into a thing.
Thinking
you have to add a sufficient amount of olive oil so it... Yeah, with turmeric baths. There we go. That can be our sponsor.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we have the title for this episode. Dare Not and Turmeric
Baths. You know, like, I mean, that it's not the clumsiness of it. It's not that it's going to work for some people and not others and that we're not nuanced enough in it. It is the drive or the desire to alleviate the anxiety by finding the answer. By, the problem seems to be the unassurity of not knowing, which I would take the exact opposite response. It's like the not knowing is constitutive of life, that the knowing part ends up being a self-perpetuating cancer. That's like, I'm narrowing. It is, again, to return it, it is the problem of Nazism or the problem of fascism, is that as soon as you've developed the final solution, whatever that's anti-inflammation or, you know, like no more undesirables in the world or anything else, doesn't matter what it is, right? The more clearly you articulate that end and the more you move toward it, the more fanatical and the more sort of like rarefied that, you know, that impulse becomes, the more totalizing like everything is subsumed under the desire to realize that that end. So I always think that fascism is the ultimate death drive, right? It's like, what counts as Aryan enough? Certainly not me. Certainly no one that's ever lived.
Right. And he stresses...
In the name of life optimization, too.
In the name of life optimization, right? Yeah. The death... Like, life optimization is its own particular brand of death drive.
But and then Derrida stresses, though, and I like this one section because it really resonates with the whole Hegelian thread that I take up, but where he stresses that, you know, our culpability in, for example, fascism, racism... That's irreducible. So you don't get to buy out of the really bad shit either. Like, the contamination is the
That's
bottom
crucial.
Line.
We haven't brought up that word, the necessity of contamination. But that, and that also kind of resolves the responsibility question, which is like, it's always, I mean, his direction is different, which is like, you never get to feel good about the decision. Yeah. But the flip side would be, you never have to feel bad about it either, right? Like, it's never simply your responsibility, because that's the structure of contamination. And that, I mean, that strikes me as, that's the Nietzsche lesson, right? That's the whole sort of necessity of interpretation, is the necessary contamination. Mm-hmm. Nothing is truly either good or bad.
Can I, in the kind of spirit of thinking with, I want to run something by you that I feel is related to what we've been discussing. And so, you know, I'm working on this book that's kind of on, you know, different rhetorical accounts of gambling, and Derrida on the decision is part of that. The wager as an expression of performative becoming is part of that. I've been thinking about So you remember several years ago now, the shooting in Las Vegas, the
sniper
guy got the room in Mandalay Bay and murdered all of those people at the concert. So he was like kind of a big time video poker player, was on in their systems, high roller, like cycling through, I can't even remember the numbers now, but a ton of money on video poker, which is this kind of game. It's like and there is a spectrum of gambling, of how involved you are in the gambling game. So something like poker, for example, you have to make decisions, and I mean that as simply as possible, at every turn, right? Like, how much am I going to bet now? Do I believe what this person is suggesting with their behavior? So all of these moments, you are kind of actively making these decisions just in order to participate in the gambling, in that game. And video poker, on the other hand, it just becomes this. I mean, it is. It's a, there is optimal play. You know, if you get XYZ, you dump two, you keep three. I mean, and there's a lot of research on how fast people just roll through that money. They don't even care when they win, right? Something happens to you if you're addicted to video poker where the win is actually a problem because it slows down your play. Like, if you've won so much, you need to get a hand pay. Like, people don't actually want to win. They just want to, like, obliterate themselves in this process whereby you are totally removed. Like, you're really not making any decisions at all. You've memorized, and it moves so quickly. And that's what this guy was, and he did that. Like, I was reading, he was morning of every day leading up to it. He went down to the bar, was playing. I think there was even reporting on how much money, you know, it was a lot of money that he was putting in. So he was rolling through a ton of hands, you know, dozens, maybe hundreds of hands. A minute. I don't know how, but you can move it really fast. You can adjust the speed. And
probably playing multiple games at the same time.
Right, yeah. You can have like six on a screen. I mean, I don't know what the setup was, but it kind of strikes me that it's not unrelated. I don't know. You know, it's like that kind of right, you've chosen the game, and it is. It is a kind of capitalistic, it's like, it's part of this dissociated experience of being in the casino, where you're really taking yourself out, you know? And that's the person who went up and...
It's a particular kind of individuation, though, because as you said, there's a kind of a self-obliterating, the act of goal seems to be actively to remove decision-making,
yeah,
and completely subsume myself to, you know, a particular...
Right. Like, you could not do it, you could not play, but there's something about, it's like, it's almost a game that you play so you don't have to decide.
Yeah.
Right? Right. And in a way that's...
Fully automate yourself.
Yeah.
In a way that's more...
That's the goal.
Right. It would be... If you weren't playing, you'd have to make other decisions in your life. Like, you know,
right.
Like, should I drink this coffee or not?
Like
whatever.
A coping mechanism. It's an anxiety coping mechanism. My immediate response is, like, some people cope with anxiety by finding certainty in the moral righteousness of what they're doing. Other ones obliterate responsibility by completely subsuming themselves to the machinery of... the game or the chemical
or the habit. Like, every morning I have the same smoothie, right? Like, and I don't have to, it's so reassuring because I don't want to have to fucking think about what I'm going to eat, right? Like, I just go through the, like, I'll get to the point where I'm actually making the smoothie and I realize I don't remember making the smoothie, right? Like, I don't remember actually putting the stuff in there because it's become so ritualized and habitualized, and it's great. Like, that's one less thing that I have to think about, right? So that sense of removing consciousness,
the self,
you know, as
that's,
yeah, removing the self.
It's like
no, a salve, as in like the consciousness is a wound. Oh. Decision making consciousness is a wound. The repetition habit is a salve that alleviates one of that pain.
And in a difficult way, I mean, that's what Derrida's decision is, right, it is a giving yourself over. You don't get to have a kind of active control over it. And yet, I think the way that he talks about the decision, it seems to hang on to a kind of, I guess responsibility is the word I'd want to use. Not simple responsibility, but
we're talking about this entirely in terms of the consequences for the person who engages in the practice. What there is not is any thought whatsoever of anything outside of that loop, right? I mean, that's where the Vegas guy is a little bit of different. He's not making a smoothie. He's killing other humans, right? Like, so that's a different kind of, I mean, there's a consequence to the other in terms of that which is outside of him that's just like erased, right? So there's different versions of machinics, I think. Some of them integrate otherness or the aleatory or the outside into the system, and others close that off.
Because there's a different spirit animating the two as well, is the sort of like the subject, subjecting myself to the machinery of the video game or whatever, or the habit or whatever else it is precisely to alleviate the anxiety, to absolve myself of the responsibility and of the anxiety in particular. The kind of like giving oneself over to the decision that Derrida was talking about is an anxiety amplifying device. It is not an ownership of anxiety, but a willingness to become perpetually perpetually involved with precisely, it's not a fleeing from anxiety. It's a maybe not a rushing to anxiety.
No, it definitely is.
Like
I mean, I totally agree. I totally agree. There is some sort of little bit of resist, like playing out the algorithm. Like that strikes me as a little closer to the video poker game than this other version that I think Derrida has more.
That's where you say like there's something interesting to this guy's desire, right? There is. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is in terms of an interruption of the self as this kind of conscious agent making choices, that it just becomes this like, I am becoming machine, so I want to not have to make decisions, and I don't even want to win. Right, like that's an interesting way. I mean, think of the Deleuze stuff on the dice row, right? Like the bad players are the ones that want to win. These folks don't want to win, so these are the good players in a certain sense, right? That they're just like they just want to play and disappear into the playing of the game.
But they don't care about futurity at all. They don't care, right?
That's right. There's another component to the machine that is just not present in their circuit.
Yeah. And obviously, it's not to say that, you know, one is causally linked or even reasonably linked to the other, but it just seems like
it's an interesting sight to think in. I mean,
I agree. Like that's where, to me, that's where the Nietzsche stuff is so great. It's like, hey, there is an reactive way of becoming machinic, and there's an active way of becoming machine. You know, it's not simply good or bad, and that the sort of elision of responsibility is not simply good or bad, right?
But the clearest link that I see between that sort of that particular kind of coping mechanism of the sort of susception within the machine is the conviction that it allows for, like, even just like, you know, the anterior decision made is again saying like, I know when I am dealt, you know, pocket queens, this is what I do. And, you know, the peace of mind that provides, the conviction that provides, to me is cut from a very similar cloth. My reading on, you know, mass shootings is sufficiently limited, but like my very vague sense is that like, there's a certain kind of conviction that accompanies mass shootings or like these kinds of senses of violence, is that this is unquestionably the right thing to do, or unquestionably the thing to be done. That the, you know, there is no space for alternate. I was dealt, you know, I am looking at a pair of pocket queens. This is what has to happen.
Well, and for Heidegger and for Hegel, there's a direct connection between the comfort of identity and the comfort of assuming a subject position and the violence that compels.